On episode 290 of the Tennis Files podcast, you'll learn how to play aggressive tennis with Coach Emilio Sanchez.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles. We win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Welcome to the Tennis Files Podcast, bringing you advice from the top minds in tennis to help you improve your game. And now, here's your host, Mehrban Iranshad.
Hey there, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I hope you're doing well and keeping safe. On today's episode, I went back to my archives. I'm actually in Nottingham, England right now for a poker festival, which has been a blast. But on the way here, I was listening to a few prior episodes, and one that really stuck to me was this one, my interview with Emilio Sanchez from 2020. Emilio, if you don't know, achieved a career high ranking of number 7 in the world in singles and number 1 in doubles. And he won 3 Grand Slam doubles titles and a silver medal in the 1988 Olympic Games in doubles. So he is very accomplished and he's a great coach. Now he's the co-founder of the Sanchez Casal Academy, where he helps a lot of players achieve their true potential. And on the show, you'll learn how to become a more aggressive player, why it's important to your long-term success to be more aggressive, how to become a better thinker on the court, Emilio's top returning strategies, how Emilio reached the top 10 in the world, and a lot more. So I really hope that you enjoy this very insightful interview, in my humble opinion. And with that, here it is.
Emilio, first of all, I want to really thank you for coming onto the podcast and giving us your time.
No, thanks to you for thinking me.
Oh, of course, of course. I mean, I went on YouTube and watched a lot of your matches, really some great matches that you've had over the years. I want to ask you, you know, first off, growing up, you have an incredible family history. I mean, obviously, your sister, Arantxa, she had so many great matches like you. And then you have your brother, Javier, who played professionally as well. So I was wondering, between you, your sister, and your brother, which one of you kind of took the lead as far as, like, who looked up to who?
Well, I am the second one in the family. My older sister, Marisa, she was a great player in Spain, but at the time, the women's tennis in Spain was not so developed, and so she decided to go to the college in the U.S. So she went and studied at Pepperdine, and she had a great college career there. And then I was the second one. So I was the one opening the doors, I suppose, for my other two brothers, for Javier, who is 3 years younger than me, and Arantxa, which is 7 years younger. So I was kind of like the first one opening, even if Javier was number one junior in the world. He won Wimbledon, so he was really looking like a top possible player, and that later on he became. And then we had my sister, which my sister was my little sister. But when she decided at 17, which is I was almost 24, so I already was at the top 10, I was very famous. So she was known as my sister, but she decided to win the French Open in 1989. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, from one day to the other, I became her brother. So she was number one in singles and in doubles, and so she was the one that having the best results from all, and the biggest champion from the four siblings.
Great stuff, Emilio. And so how were you able to motivate, I mean, each other? Was it something where you saw something that Arantxa was doing and then you tried to one-up her, and then maybe she saw your accomplishment and tried to one-up you? Like, how was that relationship as far as the competitiveness?
Well, with my brother, it was more rivalry. So like, because 3 years is not so much. So I was already in the top 20 in the world when he started to play on the tour. And suddenly he went very fast and started to play as well. So we had a lot of matchups, which was always uncomfortable, more for him than for me because I was older. And for him, well, he struggled a bit, the older brother and helping him and so on. So for him was a bit more difficult until at the latest stage of the career that he started to beat me also. So it was a bit difficult. With Arantxa, it was kind of like a mirror thing more than a rivalry, because for her, I was always a reference and I was helping her a bit with the coaching and I think it was more like kind of like support, and then suddenly she started to do really well, but she always had this thing, this respect for whatever I was telling her, and so we always had a fairly good relationship.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful, Emilio. And so you talk about you talked about playing Javier. I mean, you know, several times. I think it was 12 times that you played him on the tour. So I was wondering. You said it was obviously uncomfortable. How were you able to, if you were able to, kind of when you played Javier, to just put away the fact that he was your brother and just kind of play the match?
Well, it's not easy, you know. You play your brother, and it's tougher. It's tough because you don't want to have that killer instinct that you have with other players, but you still want to win, and you still you have your rivalry and things. So it becomes a bit more emotional and a bit more demanding on that mental side, no. And it's more difficult to be free and do your right game and your things, but because there are other things around. But you know, you learn from it and you try to take the best. And at the end, we are tennis players and it's a tennis match, no? So what is important is that there are much more stronger things than winning a tennis match.
Exactly, Emilio. Just trying to improve every time, figuring out what you did well, what you didn't do well, and then work on that in practice court for sure. And so I was wondering, Emilio, to kind of step back and into the beginning parts of your life. At what point in your life did you actually feel that you wanted to become a professional tennis player?
Well, actually, it was very special because I didn't have much option. At some moment, I was not doing so well, and I was not growing. So I was 16 years old, and I was not growing. But suddenly, one summer, I grow and I start to beat people that I have never beat before. And from the summer when I was turning 16 until the summer I was turning 18, in only 2 years, my tennis went from nowhere to start to do well. And my transition from junior to professional, it was super fast because I played a couple satellites that they used to play at the time, and then I played a couple of these big events at the time was the Grand Prix, and I qualify and I make the semis and I win enough points to make the next tournament a special exam. So almost in the first semester of the year, I was 16th in the world and I got in the French Open. So I almost had no choice because I didn't have time to doubt what to do or not to do, you know, like I rocket to the top 100, and then once you are there, obviously you become like kind of like a pro. So it was not, it was not an option. So I was very lucky. I didn't have to play almost any qualies. And today that's impossible. Nowadays, you really need to be there for 3-4 years before you even if you are super gifted junior, normally it takes so much longer to arrive up there.
Yeah, for sure, Emilio. And I kind of want to dissect a little bit, at least you talk about from 16 to 18, you started beating people that you didn't before. And you did talk about a growth spurt. But I mean, was it just the growth spurt, or what was it in your game that maybe you changed, or something that happened maybe mentally that allowed you to just all of a sudden, you know, rocket up to the rankings?
Well, I think that the fundamentals are there, depending on what is your background and with who you learn and what they teach. taught you. So I suppose that I had good fundamentals, so good technique. And tactic, I start to order it better. So the tactic, I start to know what to do in the matches better as you mature. So those two pillars, they go very much together, the technical and the tactical. But without the physical, there is no mental. So the physical pillar, when I grow and I become strong, allow me to have the quality and the intensity and the passion, because I started to love something that before, when I was losing and so, I didn't love to no one likes to lose, and no one likes to be there practicing and losing, because it's no fun. So what is fun is to compete and win. if you compete and lose, it's no good business for anybody. So when I put together this physical pillar, and then the mental pillar start to become stronger, and then you can work your tactics and you can use your tools, your technique much easier, and that helped me a lot to challenge the rest of the people and to go much faster on the rankings.
Great stuff, Emilio. And when you talk about the strategy, that's obviously one big piece of the whole puzzle. How did you approach learning the strategy? I mean, did you study it, or was it just a matter of your coach said, okay, we're going to do this strategy, and then you just absorbed it in your brain and then it became automatic? Or what was your process for learning strategy?
Well, no, the key for me is that there is something that allows you to compete, that there is something that you do really well. So there is has to be or the serve or the serve and volley or the forehand, or normally the serve and the forehand are almost a must for everybody today. So everybody has to have a serve and a forehand. So, but how you do the forehand? You do it cross court, inside out. You do top spin, flat, inside the court, outside. So there's many variables on every one of the shots that is what is going to give you the chances to be able to be competitive and to win those matches. No, so I always say that you have some gifts, some tools that they're going to give you the matches. And then the other tools, you have to compensate them. They are not as good, but they cannot be super weak. They have to be almost at the same level, that you cannot have something that the opponent finds that damages your equation. So it's very important to compensate the weaknesses and to use a lot the strengths. And that if you see the great players, yesterday Djokovic was playing and Shapovalov was playing amazing. Mm-hmm. But at the end, what Djokovic came out with the win, because he was doing what he does well. The returns, the playing deep, the moving the opponent. So that's how he ended up winning a match that he had lost. No? So I think that's really, really important. And the tennis players become experts of excelling with their strengths and not having very strong weaknesses.
All right, great.
And you have to be a very complete player. Mm.
For sure, especially in the pro game. So Emilio, I mean, you talk about obviously trying to play your strengths as much as possible in the points, and then, you know, maybe your weaknesses, at least improving them so that they're not being destroyed by your opponent. But can you kind of talk about like maybe an example or how to set up the points so that you can actually like utilize your strengths more and then like minimize your weaknesses?
Sure. Well, in today tennis at super high levels, the boys normally they in the top 100, they winning over 70% of serves. So the ones that they save normal, they win 75 or something. The general population, they win more than 80% of the serves. And the super servers like Isner or Karlovic or Federer, they win over 90% of serves. But a guy like Nadal wins 90% of his serves. So that means that the serve becomes so important, because it's how you initiate the game. And then there is the next couple, three shots that they are so key to be able to keep the initiative. So the serve gives you the initiative. And if you are capable with your strength, so if you have good forehands to use it after the serve, you're going to increase the amount of serve games that you're going to win. So if you increase the number of serves, and then you are more in the save area, because if you win 90% of serves, if you are a good returner and break a lot of serves, and then you are going to be in pretty good shape. if you don't break so much, and then you have a problem. It's like Karlovic serves very well, but breaks very little. So his matches are always very level. So there, if he loses one game of his serve, and then he almost is almost for sure that he's going to lose the set, no? But the best players are always the ones that they manage to take away the initiative from the server. So you have the best returner in the world, everybody says, is Djokovic today. No, but the one who makes more breaks is Nadal. Mm. So maybe Djokovic has better first return, but Nadal has the follow-up after the return is better because he breaks about 35% of games. So imagine Nadal, every three games that you serve, he's going to break you one. How safe he is with his serve? So he's very comfortable. But because he wins 90%, so that's why he's so strong. Because on top of winning his serve, he's very strong in breaking serves. Mm-hmm. The second one in breaking serves is normally Djokovic. And for example, who plays a bit more on the edge is Federer, because Federer breaks about 25%. So when they match up together, so if Nadal breaks 35 and Djokovic and Federer breaks 25, so 10% at that level is a lot. And the serve is almost the same, even if Federer maybe is 92-93% of win serve and Nadal 90%. So there is the matchup between the two. So at the end, if you are able to take away the initiative and use your strengths with the serve of the other one, and then that's when you're going to have very good chances of breaking.
Great stuff, Emilio. And so let's say maybe step in the amateur's shoes. I know you work with a lot of high-level players, but what are maybe some basic like return strategies or tips that can help us increase our chances of breaking our opponents?
Well, any level is the same. The only thing is that at amateur level, you're going to go down, and with the, let's say, a club player who wins 60% of serves, is going to be very strong. Very strong player.
Yeah.
So, because the other one is also going to be lower than that. So that means that if he's lower than that you're going to make a lot of breaks. So at the end, it's always a equation of the points that you manage to win with the mistakes of the other one. So if you are returning at club level, my advice will be always to find a return that is very safe, but it has a lot of length. Okay. So in club level, you tend to play a lot of balls in the middle of the court. What I will try to find is to see if you have kind of a return that you can play a bit deeper. And if you play a bit deeper, the other one is going to have to go more far. So that means that then you're going to be able to step in. And then you're going to be kind of like dancing. If you are able to return deep, you have a big chance that to be able to play with your strengths after, whatever are. You know, like if it's the slice or the forehand or whatever it is. So that's really important. To be able to return deep, it's very important to see the line of the ball of the serve and the height of the ball and the speed. So you can, many times at club level, the problem that they have is that they try to make the same shot independently of the speed of the ball and the height of the ball that they're going to hit it. And then suddenly they say, why this ball goes to the fence and the other one goes to the net? Is because you are not watching well the ball of the opponent. And that anticipation is don't start with the opponent, it starts with your own shot. If you play deep, there is a big chance that the shot from the opponent is going to be short. And then you are going to be more comfortable. Mm-hmm. It can be long also, it can be deep as well, but there is a lot of chances that is not deep.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the best basic strategies is hitting the deep ball and yielding the short ball. But that reminds me, Emilio, I saw a video maybe 45 minutes long or so of a presentation you gave. And I know there was a part of it where you had two juniors playing, or actually most of it. And then I think you were criticizing one of the juniors because they weren't moving forward. You know, when they had like a short ball, the footwork wasn't there. They're just waiting there with the open stance for the ball. Yeah. So I was wondering, you know, that's basically the next shot if you hit a good return. Can you talk about some keys to the footwork and the importance of moving forward on these shots instead of just waiting?
Well, that's one of the things today. The pro players play so fast and so deep that they have very few chances to move to the ball because they play at super high level. So they're going to play very, very few short balls. Okay, so but they're going to do it. So the thing that the people don't see is that because if, I don't know, whoever they like, Shapovalov or Djokovic or Thiem or whatever, they play so many times back and waiting for the ball. It's not because they want to wait. It's because of the length of the ball of the opponent. So at the moment that the opponent leaves a short ball, they're going to move to the ball because they want to beat the ball. So, but when you don't train properly and you always waiting for the ball, when there is a short ball, and then you almost don't arrive to the ball. And that it goes with the very fast surfaces or with this training at super high speeds, you know. So, and that's one of the reasons why the players have difficulties in moving towards the ball. And when they start to improve that, and then they become way much better players. And it's something like maybe today more, you cannot move towards the ball more than 15% or 20% of the time, because the most of the balls you're going to have to wait for the ball and or way away or go away from the ball. But since there is big results only waiting for the ball and playing waiting for the ball, no one has the need to go to the ball. So that's why many people today are not capable of arriving to volley, because they don't see that opportunity, that 15% of opportunities, they don't see it and they don't walk to the ball. And then the net is much far away, so they cannot volley. Instead, who are the best players in the world are the ones who walk better to the ball. They're the ones that inside the court, they open better the court. They are more initiative and they open better the court. And are those players which are capable of playing very well, waiting for the ball and stepping on the back foot and or even on the front waiting. But when the ball is short, they open the court and they step in and they arrive to the net. And if you take Nadal now, if you take Federer, if you take the best players, are the ones that they step better and they push more the opponent because they want to have the control of the center of the court. And then that's, I think, one of the lacks that we have in the tennis today. In our time, we could walk to the ball more because we were not playing so deep as today. But you have to adapt to the times and try to find the best possible player that you are. You know, you try to step into the ball.
For sure, Emilio. And I mean, how do you like to train that? I mean, is it more like feeding short balls and just instructing the player? Or like, what's your approach to getting mentally and also strategically the player to get to do this more?
Well, the thing is that the player has to be convinced that every opportunity that he has to take the ball more inside the court, they have to try to do it and just stepping more towards the ball. And it has to be like a commitment. You still can play not doing so, and you can still win not doing so, but you're going to become much better player, because what we want is that when I wanted as a player was to become the best player I was able to become. And what I want today as a coach is that my students have the maximum tools that they can have to be able to compete better. So, but if they never enter the court, they will never volley. And if they never volley, they never develop that part of the game. So that's something that is a requirement. It takes work. It takes commitment, effort from the player, because it's easier waiting and hitting the ball and destroying the ball. But I think that that's a kind of player that is not building the game. I like the players that they build the game. And the transition that Nadal has done in the last 2-3 years is because before he was waiting for the forehand so far and playing from so far, when they start to open the court from him, he realizes that he had no chance. So he had to make this incredible transition of, instead of waiting for the ball from the back foot, now he's stepping on the front foot and he's much more aggressive and he arrives more to volley. And he's playing much better inside the court. Shapovalov is doing the same. Before, he was waiting, turning every shot with the open stand and so, and he was not doing nothing. Now that he's stepping on the ball, yesterday he didn't win because he the other one was very fortunate, but he played better in some parts of the match. He played much better than Djokovic. So this year, Shapovalov has a big chance to do much more damage than before because he's now stepping much better inside the court.
Great stuff again, Emilio. And you know, speaking about the footwork aspect, so in order to become a more aggressive player, would you say that we actually have to maybe like do less open stances and then look to step in more? Is that kind of what we should be thinking about with the footwork change?
For me, totally. For me, totally. People say, no, if you step to the ball, it's all tennis or it's how they play before. But no. For me, is a way that you generate the time to be able to step on the ball and beat the ball. So it's much more aggressive, and is the concept of the open stand is to play with the is to make the shot with the outside foot. You know, the concept of the step into the ball, using also the back foot to be able to transfer the weight. So you're using the back foot the same as in the open stand. The only thing is that you're using all your body. So it's something that the people, okay, sometimes I'm going to have to go open stand because I want to have more reach to the ball to be able to try to do something similar if I was stepping on the ball. But it's not going to be possible because with a circular rotation, you are never going to generate the same amount of power as with the lineal transfer of weight. The power that you have to generate here and the open stand far away from the body and the rotation that you have to have compared and the speed of the racket that you have to put is so much more effort and you go away from the area than when you step on the ball and you just let the racket, the inertia of the racket do the shot and open the court. So it's if you really see the matches and count the point well, why we are able to play the 1+1 or the 1+1+1 and most of the points are finishing 3 or 4 shots. Because thanks to the serve, you are able to step on the ball and open the court. That's a key way of going and to opening the court. If you prefer to serve and then make the open stand and also win the point because you have the time, is limiting you as a player. It's limiting you because you're going to still are able to make a winner, but you are not going to be able to follow if the other one sees the ball to close in the net. You are not going to be able to do it 3 or 4 times in a row. You just have to, what I call, destroy the game. Just go for the winner. And that way of playing, it can be good for a while, but most of the people who play like that, at some moment when they start to lose some matches, they don't know. They don't have nothing else. They only have that. And when that doesn't work, and then you become more player without the confidence. And then it's very difficult to play that way. If you learn to play, you can play at that speed, you can play at much slower speed, and still have the initiative. Still be a better player. And that gives you many more tools.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Yeah, a lot more tools. And this is something that I wish I did earlier in my game. You know, I was always the kind of person who's counterpunching, just grinding from the back of the court. And so it's been, you know, kind of tougher for me to mentally shift to be more aggressive. But I mean, this is great advice, obviously, but also for those of us who are aging too, you know, we can't just from the backcourt all the time transition, go up.
You are a counterpuncher. That means that you have a good eye and good, you see well the line of the ball. So, but if you will see better, where are you playing your balls? To win time and do what you're doing far from the line, do it more closer to the line. And then in some moments, the other one is going to be short. So those moments you're going to convert to aggressive and dictating moments for your game instead of always having to counterpunch, which is an incredible tool because you had Andy Murray and Hewitt, which are unbelievable counterpunches because they go so well behind the ball. But if you are able to combine that, like with Andy, the years that he played the best, he was with Lendl, he was counterpunching, but he was stepping to the ball and taking the ball high and arriving to the net. Mm-hmm. Some other years he only played counterpunching and he making much more effort, but he was not as aggressive and not as better outcome. So if you follow better what is your game and how much length, you're going to have more time for the next shot. But you understand that the mentality today is to play the shot, not to play the shot, to play the next shot. Understand? So if I go open stand, I destroy the ball, I just go for the winner, I'm not thinking in the next shot.
Right.
Where is the opponent? I am thinking in finishing, whatever it is, out or in. What I am asking you is to play that shot, to play it deep enough that the other one has to go away, leave the short ball for you to start playing and to play whatever shot you want to play.
I feel like you're a good chess player, Emilio. Do you play chess?
Well, you know, I did my career and I didn't have big weapons. I serve well, I have good forehand, but you know, like I play in the time that we had, my prior generation was McEnroe, Lendl, Gomez, all these top guys. And then my generation was with Billander, Becker, Edberg, Muster, and all these guys. And the generation after was Agassi, Sampras, Curie. So three generations playing at the same time was like 15 players without counting Mechir, Cash, and all these other like players at my level. So it was all the games completely different. So with very little game, I had to challenge those guys and play at the same level as them. So I needed to do those different situations to be able to play with them because I didn't have like a big serve like Boris or like big forehand like Lendl that every time they touch the ball, they make these super big points, you know? So yeah, I really had to work the short ball with a deep ball and then the ball, you know, like play the game. And that's the way I like the tennis because that's the way I grow it. It's like I was playing with 15 guys in the top 15 that they all play different. So you had to also to adapt your system and your way to 15 different players. Today, many players play very similar. And the only ones that they are a bit different are Federer and Nadal and Djokovic. The rest, they play very similar game. So I think that the differences and the different games are very good for our sport.
For sure.
And if the people will develop more things, they will have more different games. But the people, they just stick to what it works and they have big capabilities of improving. So when a player like Shapovalov in some months improves so much, it becomes that he's working properly and he's gonna yesterday arrive to volley a lot with Djokovic, which before he was not arriving. So now he's building the game. So now he can start to do a lot of more things.
Yeah, for sure, Emilio. And I'm curious, you know, I talked to Taylor Dent last week, and he obviously was a big serve and volleyer type of player. I mean, in your opinion, do you think a serve and volleyer could be still successful in the game today on the men's side?
Well, he could still work properly, but normally the serve and volleyers, also they try to not play so much from the back, you know, but you have some players like that at some moment, for example, Federer, when he restarted to work with Edberg, he started to go much more to serve and volley, and still today in his game he goes more to the net than at some stage of his career, you know. So if you serve well and volley well, you still can do it. The thing is that it's going to be more demanding because the returns are really good and they are really fast. So you have to adapt to the situation where you serve very well, but you have time to arrive to the net. Normally in the second serves today is much more difficult. Like before you will serve serve and volley both serves. Today's the second serve are very difficult to volley.
So Emilio, you're talking about commitment. You mentioned that a couple of times. And so I found it very interesting. I watched a video about you, which is like the day in the life of Emilio Sanchez. And you mentioned that you woke up, you know, in the morning, like before 6 o'clock, but you hated to wake up in the morning. So I was wondering, you know, assuming that's accurate. I mean, you said it, so I guess it's accurate. But how are you able to eventually like get used to waking up at 6 a.m.? Because this is very important. I read a lot about morning routines and how that's important in building a great life. So how are you able to do that even though you hated doing it?
Well, when you compete, I was one of type of player that always needed hours to rest. The recovery is very important. So I get used, you create the habit of sleeping long. Yeah. And because you want to perform, and I had the kind of game that I needed my wheels to be able to do well. So I needed to be rested and well. So, but then the real change comes in, not only because of the work, but the real change comes in when you have kids. When you have kids, you know, I remember when my first kid was born, I remember that year I was still, I think I was coaching my sister, and we were in Wimbledon. And in Wimbledon, there is always the middle Sunday, no one plays. So it's closed in Wimbledon, and it's a holiday. So you say, okay, so tomorrow is a holiday. You don't have to train. You don't have to. You maybe you go to the park. You walk a bit. You run. You jog. You prepare for the next day. So, but then I remember that it's a Sunday, and then at 6:30 in the morning, the kid starts to cry. Yeah. There is no Sunday for these kids. There is no holiday. You know. So that's when you really start to get used to wake up really, really, really early, you know. But apart from this story that is real, I think that the learning process of commitment, it comes from the tennis itself. For me, the tennis has been an incredible tool, because tennis is a science of habits. So to hit well the forehand, inside or outside, or so, you need to hit it so many times, or to defense forehand or offense forehand. So why we are not able today to walk so much to the ball? Because we don't repeat it so much as before. If we will repeat it, we will do it well, like the players before were doing it. So, but we focus so much on the defense forehand that we forget about the offense forehand. So the same is on the day-to-days and your organizational skills. So if I have organization and I'm supposed to have here, we start the practice at 7 in the morning, and I have 15 coaches and whatever number of 50 students, and I'm not there, I think I'm not the mirror anymore. So I think that is, when you decide to do something, you have to try to do it like when you play a match. When you play a match, you give your best all the time. So I try to do this in my life. In whatever I do, I try to play the match as a tennis match, because tennis has taught me everything. And I cannot do this interview and not trying to tell whatever I have inside, because then I'm not playing a match with you, you know. So the everything is like that. So if you really care about the situations and about the things, it's very important the discipline that you put to the things, and the effort that you put to the things, and the attention and the commitment. And if at the moment that you are not there, at the moment that you are not putting your 100%, you start to lose the match, mm-hmm. whatever it is, that match, you know, that is important for you.
That's right, Emilio. But were you always a disciplined person? I mean, did that just develop from like your team around you and coaches that said, hey, you must do this in order to be successful? Like, how did that actually develop inside of you?
Yeah, well, in my house, I think my mom was the most disciplined, or is still the most disciplined person I ever see. Like the other day, she went to the doctor and they told him, you have to do these exercises. She will not forget one day of the exercises. So she's like super disciplined. She comes from her family, her parent, her father was from the army. So very structured. Mm. So, and I think that was very important for us to develop as players, because that gives us the order and the capabilities of of moving forward. So that first stage was very important. My mom is super disciplined. Then the coach that I had all my career was super disciplined also. We always had to do the things and arrive on time and do the pre-match and after match, and they go clean the game after the match and do the right things. And I remember, like, when I was playing, if one night I will do no good or I will go out the next morning, I'm there. Doesn't matter how many hours I sleep. So that I developed through the career as a player. And after that, if in some moments I miss, for whatever reason, the people around me always was also very disciplined. And some of my coaches here are so focused and so disciplined with what they do. That when I have some moments or some doubts about it, they remind me about how important it is. And my people, they are super, super disciplined. And for me, they are role models that I follow in the occasions that I am not capable of doing it myself.
Yeah, that's really smart of you to surround yourself with such great people to, you know, keep you accountable and help you. So great job with that. And so you did something, Emilio, that's practically unheard of, which is you got to number one in the world in doubles in April of 1989 and then number seven in the world in April 1990. So, I mean, I don't think there's really any pros that I can remember recently that have accomplished this. So how were you able to be at an elite level at both singles and doubles, like at nearly the same time?
Well,
it must have been tiring, huh?
Yeah, well, at that moment, anyway, I was coming from a moment where almost everybody was playing the singles and the doubles. So starting with McEnroe and Bilander Nystrom and Forge Noah and everybody at the time, we were playing singles and doubles. And it was Živojinović, Ivanišević, and Edberg Jarry. So they were really incredible couples that they play both, and I think was really good for the game because it created a lot of attention and the only thing is that as the athlete improve on the tennis world. So the athlete, what it does is maximizes the performance. Mm-hmm. So, and what happens is that when you go to play a tournament and everything is centered towards the singles. So when you play singles and doubles, normally the doubles, they're going to take away some energy for the athlete to perform in singles. So if you play, like, let's say, first and third match, so first, let's say 12 o'clock and then 5 o'clock, you still have time to dinner and to recover. But if you play second and fourth, and then you already the dinner, you already maybe don't arrive on time. But if you play third match starting at 12 and then fifth match, you're gonna have to adapt to the situation and your dinner is gone and you're probably gonna go late to bed. And so the next day you have to play first and third. And then you have a problem because you don't have time to recover to give your best. And that's why the physical demands become so high that the people had to decide to choose not to play doubles to be able to perform better in singles, to be more rested, to be focused on only on one thing. And that's the pity, because I think the double to me, it developed me as a player in a way that make me much better single player.
Right.
I make my efforts, but I was way much better player. I remember one year in Kitzbühel that it rained Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. We started the tournament on Friday morning. So I played two singles and one double on Friday. Saturday, I played two singles and one double. And Sunday, I played the final, best of five, and then two doubles. And I won the singles on the doubles in 3 days, 9 months.
My God.
So I was destroyed for a month after that. But you know, like when you play continuously singles and doubles, you also develop these skills and this way of doing that you become better physically as well. So you could last longer and play more and more. So it's the body takes accepts everything from if you train it well, it can have incredible results. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an incredible result because you are able to do things that you never expect, but because you train it to do it. And so if you do that one time without doing it normally, and then the body breaks. But when the body is used to do it, and then if you run a 5K, if you train the body, you can run a 10K. If you give the rest and train it again, you can run a 20K, and then a 40K. And then look at these guys, they're running a 100K because they can run 3-40Ks in 1 week. Mm-hmm. So they become superpower people, you know, because they train the body to be able to be adapt to that.
That's right, Emilio. And so with doubles, I mean, are you happy with the current, you know, format and like, because I know that they've shortened it a bit over the years. So, and probably with the concerns that you laid out, although I guess they still haven't gotten as many top players that you from singles as you'd want, but into doubles. But are you okay with the format? Is there anything you would change with it?
Well, it's becoming more level and level. So it's shortened matches and it becomes more difficult even for the good players to make a difference because they have less games to do it. You know, so it's something that they decided. I don't think if I was asked about what was the solution. I think that the solution is on the programming, because of and the number of matches. So what is important or what is not important for the tournament. So if they only going to show the TV the singles, the doubles is not so much important. So they can reduce the amount of games. That's what they're doing. But for me, if they will give more importance also to doubles, they will have to give the time to the people to be able to recover. So maybe make smaller draws and then maybe make smaller draws for or combined draws. I don't know. They will have to find a format where the person can have time to recover and doesn't have a disadvantage compared to that one that don't play. Because if not, it's not fair, you know. So and it's been going that way all the time. So. But the tournaments normally they don't like so much. They don't show so much doubles, and the good players they don't play them because it's very draining physically and mentally. Because as the same as I tell you before, when you have to reload the tank to play a doubles, and so you start in the morning, you have the tank full, you play loose singles, you empty your tank, you reload it again, go to play doubles, you empty it again, and then you have to reload it for the next day. So, but it's a big disadvantage to have to empty the tank two times instead of one a day. So that's the big problem. Yeah.
I wonder if they could maybe have like doubles only tournaments. That would be interesting. But
that could be an option. And they now, for example, when they did the Labor Cup, doubles become very important and much fun because they make it the part of the competition that is the most important. Or in Davis Cup, when you play singles and then doubles and then in another day, and then the players can play it. But even in Davis Cup, because until now, because before was best of five, best of five, best of five, the body don't have time to recover because the body is used to play best of five, one day free, best of five. So the doubles in between becomes a big physical challenge if you have to play the third day another big singles.
Yeah, for sure, Emilio.
Because no more Davis.
I know, that's true. Well, I don't know what to say about that. But Emilio, you know, obviously you played Davis Cup and you captained Davis Cup. You won a championship in 2008, which is incredible. How different was it for you, you know, coaching versus playing?
Well, coaching is very very different from playing. Well, no, I like playing because there is nothing like playing because whatever you work, you have the outcome And there is nothing more grateful than that, you know. And coaching is coaching in normal coaching in tennis, I think, is very, very unfair, because tennis is the only sport who don't allow coaching. The only place that they allow a bit of coaching is Davis Cup, because you can be on the court. So the experience of the Davis Cup for me was amazing, because I was able to share on the court the moments, and it was an amazing experience to be able to contribute to this victory with them, being with them there and deciding who play, who don't play, and all these things. Coaching, I think now they're starting to find ways that to communicate and to do a bit better. I think they should improve more, because I think if the people will be coached, I think the tennis will be better.
So like on the women's side, you'd like to coach during the matches?
Yeah. Well, I will always allow the players, not only one time a set. I will allow them to coach, because the tennis will improve, because the player will do better, and the coaching will improve also, because people will be there and improve. When Federer and Nadal were coaching there in Davis Cup, it was an amazing thing. And you see the mindset, and you learn on the mental pillar, you learn on the physical, you learn on the tactical, you learn even on the technical, when the not play slice or slow the game, blah, blah, blah. So, and the people need to hear that, you know, but the profession for the coach is very easy. No, it's better no coach. Yeah, but then what you do? No, you let the player do the thing. I say, I'm coaching him to let him do the thing. Yeah, but they need to play better. We're losing public, we're losing people, so we need to make this sport better players, and the coaching, it can be part of that. I think it's very interesting that the people coaches.
Yeah, for sure, Milo. And I know we're going pretty long, I guess, and I know that you have to go soon, but just let me know if you need to leave. But I wanted to ask you about the Sanchez Casal Academy, obviously. And what I found interesting is you had mentioned in one of your talks that I found on the internet that when you mentioned to your friends that you wanted to build an academy in the U.S., they said you were crazy. So I was wondering, you know, how are you able to push past this sort of doubts from the outside, and maybe you had doubts within you? How are you able to just push past it and then go forward and build a successful academy?
Well, the talks are talks, you know. Look, what it counts is the facts, you know. And so right. The reality is that when you have like a place like in Spain that is doing well, and so that you decide to do another place and to go to the US, where is all the academies, the best academies in the world, and you go to fight there, is that you are a bit crazy anyway, because it's what you gonna do there, no? So, but for me, it was a personal challenge. I think for me was a moment that I needed to make this step ahead and prove myself in different ways. And I'm kind of person that I move forward, and I try to, if I make the mistake, I make it. But at the end, I just wanted to prove myself that it was a good thing. And it has been very good for me in health and in family. And I spend much more time with my kids. And so in many ways, it's been amazing. And also in the tennis side as well, because in Barcelona, I was managing and I was not in the court. Here, I'm much more in the court, and I'm enjoying that a lot. And if I was not making the move here, maybe I will not be in all these conferences and teaching other people. And it's not about teaching the kids and bringing them to try to make a dream, but we also teaching a lot of coaches and making a lot of coaches' careers and helping a lot of people. And that is something that fulfills me. So I'm very happy with the decision that I did a while ago.
Yeah, like you said, you made so much impacts on so many thousands of kids, and also coaches, giving them a way to live and enjoy themselves and their lives as well. And yeah, you have locations in Naples, Barcelona, China, Atlanta. That's incredible. We wanted to ask you, what is your mission your mission with the academy? Like, when you set out to build it, like, what in your mind was it that you wanted to accomplish?
Well, for me, it was to put together the two most important things. So the first one was the tennis. So I wanted to give opportunities through tennis, but the way to do it for me was through education. Because in my time in Spain, you either had to decide or to play or to study. So for me, that was a shock because many of the kids at my age, they quit the studies, but they didn't make it. So I don't think you have to make such a drastic decision if you are able to develop yourself as a student, but also as a tennis player at the same time. So when I was traveling the world and I see the opportunities here in the U.S., with kids that they were able to combine both things, I said, this is not happening. So that's when we started in Spain and 20 years ago in Barcelona, and we did make so many great players to the tour, but we even make many more towards the college pathway in the US. And today they have incredible jobs and careers and so thanks to tennis, because tennis is a big demand sport, but it's very tough because very few they make it. So what I wanted is that everybody who make this effort of playing so many hours and creating so many habits, they use this sport to have an opportunity in life as a tennis player. And I always tell there is this article in the New York Times that there is from the top 1,000 traders in the Wall Street, there is 500 tennis players. Why? Because the way that they play, the way that they lose points, probably in trading, they make them, maybe they lose a bit, but they buy, they sell, they stay, they fight longer, and then they make them better. And so one of the juniors that played has a hedge fund that is done so well because of the tennis part. And I think tennis is an amazing vehicle for you to do well in life.
Yeah, so many life lessons. And I feel like you should be getting free trading advice, you know, stock trading and all that from your students, you know, for all the help you've given them. Emilio, I just want to educate the audience if they're interested in your programs too, you know, like what types of programs do you have and what age groups?
Yeah, well, in my academies, we start from the bottom of the pyramids because we are clubs. So anybody who lives in the city, in the area, they can jump in and they can come with an after school program and they can do the normal 1 or 2 days a week or lessons or something. That's the bottom of the pyramid, no? And then in Barcelona, we do elementary school, middle and high school. So you go from 6 years old to 12 to 18 years old. You can do any year. You can combine the studies with the tennis. In the U.S., we do middle and high school. So you can start here, study with us when you are 11 years old until 18 as well. That's for the year programs. Okay, we do after school and academy for all the year. Apart from that, we do any type of program like weeklies, pre-seasons, pro series, everything related to any player that needs any kind of service. That for short time, let's say weeks, months, or whatever it is. And then in summer, we do summer programs. So that's where the people get to know us, they try it, and then they get excited to then come for the year and practice more often with us. And that we do in all the centers as well. So, and apart from that, we do have programs for adults, we do tournaments, we have programs for coaches. We do everything that related to tennis. Anybody who is involved with the sport and wants to improve, we probably have a program for them. And like in any place, you know, like the thing with the clubs is that you need to do so many things to have the course full all day, which is difficult because these people play in the morning, these people play in the afternoon. So you have to have always the course full. And that's when the club is moving along forward. So we do about almost everything in the tennis market.
Awesome, love it. And where can we follow you or the academy? You know, like website wise, and we'll post it on the show notes page. Your website or social media, anything?
Okay, so we have a website that has the four sides. It's sanchez-casal.com. If they want to go to one of the websites, particularly, for example, the US, is ASC-Florida.com. If they want to follow, like I have my own
like social media page.
Yeah, foundation. So it's Emilio Sanchez Vicario .org. So, but if normally the websites are all connected. We are in Facebook with academies, or I do a lot of Twitter and LinkedIn as well. So if they put my name, they can follow. And we have a very nice, inside the website, we have a very nice blog where we put a lot of articles. I have a blog also in LinkedIn. So they can find us in a lot of places if they want to read things about tennis and articles about different situations. And I'm sure they will like it. So I hope that they can follow us.
Fantastic. And I'll post all those links for sure. Emilio, I always close with this question, and you've given us a lot of great advice today, but what is one key tip that you can give our audience to help them improve their tennis games?
Wow, tennis is so difficult, but as I said before, tennis is a habit. Okay, so whatever they want to improve, that make the step out, come out from the comfort zone, and practice it, and practice it, and practice it, because it's gonna come. Okay, they just have to have the patience of stepping out of the comfort zone continuously to be able to look for the goal, and tennis is gonna pay back. Yeah, and then when they do that and they do it well, they have to re-study again and redo it to find something else. So if you have that mentality, you're going to become a great tennis player. To always, when you have something already in your pocket and you have it, you do it well, go out and find something else. Because if Nadal and Federer and Djokovic, they keep improving, how much the rest of the world we can improve? We will have their mindset.
That's right. Keep adding to the toolkit. Well, Emilio, I want to acknowledge you and thank you for a great career and also impacting so many with your academies. And I really appreciate your time today. So thanks so much for speaking with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much to you for the time. Thank you.
All right. I hope you really enjoyed that interview with Coach Emilio Sanchez. And thanks to him for making the time to be on the show. I also would really appreciate it if you would leave a review for the Tennis Files podcast, and you can do that at tennisfiles.com/Apple Podcasts or on the podcast app of your choice that you use to listen to the show. And I also want to leave you with a quote, and this one is from Laird Hamilton. And Laird said, "Make sure your worst enemy doesn't live between your own two ears." Really great, great quote, because obviously the mental aspect of it is so crucial in helping us perform our best. So it's what controls us. So with that, thanks so much for listening. And I will see you on the next episode of the Tennis Files podcast. This is your host, Mirban Aranchad, signing out.
Thanks for listening to the Tennis Files podcast. For more tips to help you improve your tennis game, visit tennisfiles.com.